Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, I'll be continuing with my ongoing series, special in-depth investigative report requiring over 15 years and over 15,000 hours of research on AIDS, a Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of AIDS. Part 11 today in this series. Now, the reason I'm doing this program at this time is because there's been an acceleration to try to discredit virtually any of the dissenters to the orthodox view that HIV equals AIDS, which equals death. The only way of determining if you have HIV is to get the HIV antibody test, and if you do have the HIV AIDS virus, then you must immediately go on a very progressive program of antiretroviral therapy. Not to do so, they consider irresponsible, and therefore anyone who would challenge it, they consider almost criminal in their irresponsibility. The American media has, with very few exceptions, and by the way, not even more progressive liberal publications have examined any of the failings of the orthodox model. So I'm providing you with a different understanding, and today I'm going to take you to the very epicenter of what I consider the fallacy of the HIV equals AIDS hypothesis. On the last program, I tried step by step, very methodically, and as often as I could in lay language, to deconstruct what they were saying was the entire rationale for their argument. And mind you, it is a theory. It's never been proven. You think it's been proven. Over 600,000 scientists working in the field think it's been proven. Every one of 700,000 doctors think it's been proven. Legislators, it hasn't. And I'm going to share the views of those dissenters. And by the way, I have qualified my dissenters. I have only accepted those dissenters who are themselves, in every other respect, ultra-Orthodox. I have not chosen anyone to quote, and all my quotes are based upon personal first-hand interviews in Australia, in Russia, in the Ukraine, in Kiev, in Switzerland, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, Italy, England, Ireland, everywhere. I've done these interviews myself, firsthand, and I have thousands and thousands of hours in these interviews. So I've selected those people who are Nobel Prize winners, who are professors emeritus, who are chairmen of departments of molecular biology and virology. So when you hear me mention someone's name, please understand that these are people who, if it weren't for the fact that they were challenging the HIV hypothesis, would be highly revered and are so. For instance, there's a professor emeritus, Dr. John Stewart, who, when I was speaking with him, and I went to England to speak with him, he said that he had had over 255 articles published in the British Medical Journal, in The Lancet, and other major publications without any problem or any questions, until he simply wrote an article questioning all the statements and assumptions made about AIDS. And he couldn't get it published. And he hasn't gotten anything published since. That's also something. I found that some of the physicians and scientists had published 200 to 500 articles individually with no problems in Journal of the American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine. But once they challenged HIV, it's as if a brick wall dropped between them and the rest of the scientific community. Even the media would not have them on unless it was to challenge them as being wrong. So those are the people who I've selected to use as my sources. Let us take another look and even go further. And I'll be referring to a Dr. Eliopoulos and her Perth group. Now, this is a group of over 15 scientists and physicians all with backgrounds in public health and biology and microbiology, who have collectively, after very careful and scholarly examination, said HIV has never been isolated. I began to present some of their information on the last program. Now there are thousands of scientists who have joined them after examining their material, looking at their arguments, and then going back to the orthodox model and challenging for the first time the orthodox model. It is not for me to say does it or does it not exist. It is merely for me to present both sides so you can determine if you wish to believe either or neither. The orthodox camp have remained without polemical resources in the battle. In fact, Dr. Peter Duisberg, who, as I showed in the last program, believes in the existence of HIV, although he dissents from other accepted views, has argued it is no longer necessary to abide by the old principles of viral isolation because they should be replaced by new ones that hinge on viral cloning. As a critic of many of the practices of modern-day science, it would be unseemly for me to abruptly switch sides, as it were, and say this one element of orthodoxy. The Koch postulates of viral isolation, and for those of you who are not familiar with Koch, Koch came to understand that in science we must observe certain phenomena. In other words, if something is going to be told to us that it causes a disease, then prove it. And there are certain postulates it must pass. For instance, you must be able to isolate it. After all, how can something kill you if you can never find it in the body? And it must be there in adequate amounts to actually do what it's supposed to do. Otherwise, it'd be like saying the man bled to death, and you say, but he only had one tiny little nick from shaving. Well, that's the only cause we know, so we'll say that that one nick caused him to bleed to death. And you say, but it's not possible. That's what Koch's postulate does. It says, do you have enough of the actual material in the body to cause the damage? Anyhow, there are several Koch's postulates. And Duisberg is saying it does meet Koch's postulates. He has argued it is no longer necessary to abide by these old principles of viral isolation. And also, the trouble is this new method of isolating retroviruses, which I will discuss in a few moments in the cloning subsection of my report today, has little to recommend it as a worthy substitute for the older principles. However, the very raising of this question, that is, of whether long-accepted scientific techniques should be abandoned in light of findings on HIV and AIDS, suggests profounder questions about the nature of scientific change. Once I will raise at the level, or I should say at the end of my discussion today, tying them in with the promise for their exploration of the Wolfgar-Latour view of scientific progress. And again, these are just names to you, but I will make it all come together and make sense. Accepting for the moment, then, that the older rules of viral isolation are still in effect, unlike Duisberg, most scientists involved in work on HIV ignore the whole problem, ignore all the old science completely, and there has been no generalized move to reject the older protocols of isolation. We can see that as Dr. Eliopoulos and her Perth group makes clear, the situations hold both irony and tragedy. In spite of AIDS being regarded as one of the gravest conditions ever to afflict the human race, no one has deemed it necessary to use a proven method to establish the existence of the putative cause of the dread disease. Instead, everybody's opted for a set of non-specific criteria and appear to imagine that if you put all these together, they will somehow metamorphosize into the right answer. So let's examine contamination. According to the classical biology, as I mentioned briefly on the last show, if the culture being used for further experiments contained not a single type of particle, but a mix of particles, then following the traditional plan for the work of the culture, if this work assumed it had an isolated entity, would be fruitless. Unless more was done to isolate the entity, one would be working with a, quote, contaminated specimens. Dr. Philpott, citing Papadopoulos' in the Perth group explains that HIV cultures were contaminated in just this disabling way. Electron microscope pictures, micrographs of samples of Gallo calls, quote, HIV isolates, unquote, and of all these, quote, HIV isolates produced by Luc Montagnier of France or since by other scientists show some objects that look like viruses, plus lots of other things, including things that clearly are not viruses. And what Eliopoulos lists as found in the samples, besides particles that resemble retroviruses, were microvesicles, which are unstable but non-infectious organelles that bud from cells, and endogenous retroviruses. These are retroviruses normally found inside the body, not brought in from outside. They are also non-infectious. I might add at this juncture that the very appearance of endogenous retroviruses in the samples plays havoc with many of these theses that claim to have isolated HIV, given that, quote, these endogenous, meaning coming from inside the body, retroviruses cannot be distinguished from exogenous retroviruses, either morphologically or chemically, unquote. Then many of the processes observed, such as budding and reverse transcriptase activity, and taken to be markers of the presence of an invasive retrovirus like HIV, could just as well be signs of an endogenous retrovirus. In fact, a number of technical scientific points, which it is not necessary to go into, such as the fact that HIV does not affect as many types of cells as theory predicted it would, even make the idea that HIV originates in an aberrant retrovirus within the body, not invading from outside, quite attractive. Now, this possibility has led Eliopoulos and her Perth group to suggest, quote, it is more probably that HIV, if proven to exist, is an endogenous retrovirus rather than an exogenous retrovirus, unquote. To go back to the discussion of contamination, we might begin by anticipating an objection. Our listener may say, well, Gary, how could such an important and obvious fact as that the cultures from HIV particles were obtained were filled with other non-retrovirus particles be overlooked by scientists working in the field for so long? Good question. Well, here is what Eliopoulos and her Perth group offer as an explanation. Perhaps it is because pictures are so powerful. There are pictures containing particles which look like a virus, and there's reverse transcriptase in the same cultures as the particles. It is possible mentally to connect particles, reverse transcription, and proteins and the antibodies that react with the proteins and make this into evidence for the existence of a retrovirus, especially for a retrovirologist. Another part of the answer might be that not until March 1997, in a study by Dr. Hans Gelderblum of Berlin's Robert Koch Institute that was printed in Virology, the official magazine of virology, were electron microscope pictures of HIV particles banded at an accepted density published so that they could be studied by the researchers. Mind you, that's 1997. When was it claimed HIV was discovered? 1984. Recall that centrifuging forces particles to separate at different densities. It should be added that there is a typical band at which isolated retroviruses tend to cluster. Gelderblum had made some progress towards separating HIV according to the first step of traditional isolation. But there are still problems. He did not achieve isolation. That is, at the band there was still a mixture of particles, not the single type that would prove isolation. Further, the fact that he had gone this far proves nothing about the reality of HIV, since, one, this may be simply a heterogeneous mix of materials, none of which is a retrovirus. Two, even if he obtained a single type of particle in the band, it may not be a retrovirus. Further steps would have to be taken to prove it was indeed a viral entity. Earlier pictures of the retrovirus were not taken from centrifuged bands. Before this, HIV may have been, quote, isolated, unquote, that is, in the limited way accomplished by Gelderblum, through banding, but photographs of banded materials had not been in print. It was only in March 1997 that it came out that, quote, the electromicrographs disclose major contaminants in pure HIV in banded gradients, unquote. Now listen to what I'm telling you, because this is very important. You've not read this in any magazine anywhere in the world. You've not heard this on any news story. You're hearing this exclusively today. This is the man who was given credit for producing the first banded picture in March of 1997. A highly respected scientist, Dr. Gelderblum. And he says in his article, quote, the electromicrographs disclose, quote, major contaminants in pure HIV in banded gradients, unquote. According to a summary that appeared in Continuing, the paper accompanying the photographs, quote, describes the contamination as an excess of vesicles, particles of cellular proteins that may contain DNA or RNA, unquote. An article in Virology done by a U.S. research team from the AIDS vaccine program in Maryland to comment on the Koch Institute photos stated, quote, it is unknown how these cellular proteins associate with the virus. The presence of microvessels in purified retroviruses has practical implications, unquote. One is that all tests that have been done on HIV heretofore are nonspecific. That is, because of the contamination, no one anywhere, not Gallo, not Exeter, no one on earth at this moment can say that they have definitively pinpointed HIV, since it may well be that the results, such as reverse transcriptase activity, are due to one of the contaminants. That is a scientific fact. And yet your brightest and best journalists in the United States, from Columbia, Harvard, why have none of them found this, caught on to this, challenged this? You're hearing it exclusively first today. From their journals, their articles, their photographs, their science is showing you their science is flawed. Dr. Eliopoulos and her Perth group brought out another problem with the pictures, noting that even the particles identified as HIV in the gradient did not resemble other known retroviruses. She uses a nautical metaphor to bring out the unprecedentedness of the finding. First, though, she stressed, quote, retroviruses are not esoteric, nuclear or cosmological notions whose postulated existence can only be inferred by indirect observations. They are particles which can be seen, albeit not with the naked eye, unquote. Gelderblum's groups, noting the particles they identified as HIV do not have the morphology of other retroviruses, makes them a contention that, quote, so totally unsubstantiated it defies belief, unquote. She further claims the 1.16 grams a milliliter band can be linked to a fishing net. The difference is that the band traps objects according to their density, not their size. Imagine a fisherman who sees in the ocean many different objects, some of which may be fish. He throws the net in, waits, and upon retrieval, the net performs a thorough examination of its contents and shows that it contains many sea creatures, but nothing that looks like a fish. Yet, strange as it may seem, he claims to have caught fish. In fact, he claims that the net was nothing else but pure fish. When we looked at the way Montagnier and Gallo's groups had, quote, supposedly isolated HIV, we saw the fundamental problem, displacing all others in terms of seriousness, was that known and valid isolation procedures had not been embarked upon. The groups had relied on, among other factors, pictures of hard-to-identify particles taken in cultures. However, when the researchers at the Koch Institute did take the first step toward fulfilling Koch's postulates on isolation by attempting to ban the retrovirus, instead of solving the problem of obtaining a purified, clear, single HIV virus, new difficulties appeared. Where Gelderblum's group expected answers, they found new questions such as these. If one of these particles really is a retrovirus, experts call HIV, what are all the others? If the HIV particles originate from the tissues of AIDS patients, where do all the others come from? If the HIV particles cause AIDS, why doesn't one or several of the other particles also in the same culture cause AIDS? None of those questions have even been addressed, let alone answered. Let's take a look at a different area. The disadvantages of technically advances, or let's use a metaphor, idols of the tribe. By idols of the tribe, Bacon referred to judgment wrapping effects which stem from humanity's biased cognitive and sensory apparatus. He says, quote, "For it is a false assertion that the sense of man is the measure of all things," unquote. On the other hand, as Bacon sees it, there are general tendencies of consciousness, such as the willingness to be overly touched by first impressions, that make for perpetual mistakes in comprehension. On the other hand, and more to the point, the senses themselves know well how to play us false. Quote, Bacon says, "But by far the greatest hindrance and aberration in the human understanding proceeds from the dullness, incompetence, and deceptions of the senses," unquote. By this he meant that the senses make us prone to such errors as, quote, "things that strike the sense outweigh things which do not immediately strike it, though they may be more important." Although Bacon was referring to our unmediated vision, which is more interested in the most prominent features of a scene, so, quote, of things invisible, there is little or no observation, unquote, this thought can be extended without violence to the idea recently expressed by Eliopoulos and her group to the effect that, quote, "pictures are so powerful." She meant that micrographs of viral-like particles look very convincing to scientists, pressing them to believe in the reality of HIV in lieu of more acceptable scientific evidence. The pictures were not evidence because they didn't see the particles as being contaminated. When it was done closer, they were contaminated. So how do you know you had a pure strain? You didn't. Therefore, it was a deception. Even closer to home is a further observation Bacon produced on this topic. Quote, "The sense of itself is a thing infirm and erring. Neither can instruments for enlarging or sharpening the senses do much," unquote. In his day, scientific instruments, in Francis Bacon's day, were in primitive condition, and so he points to us that you should not trust them. In our time, we have big science. This apparatus, ranging from radar telescopes to chromatographs, has outdistanced and supplemented the eye and hear as the proper devices for making scientific observations. So it seems fitting in our updated application of Bacon's themes that we take the idols of the tribe, as he wrote, as applicable as much to scientific instruments as to the five raw senses. Using this extension, we will be able to catch typical errors that arise from a naive faith in technology, which among scientists seems to have replaced naive faith in God reigning in Newton's day. In this section of my program, I'd like to show you how a representative tribal, meaning technological fetishizing idol, enters into the situation and, like a Pied Piper, has led scientists astray, encouraging them to draw conclusions about the existence of HIV that were not merited by any evidence. The intelligent listener who has followed me thus far may be wondering how the discoveries of the retrovirus and their followers could make any progress at all in tagging and studying what they took to be HIV if they had not truly isolated HIV as they said they had. When I interviewed Michael Verney Elliott, he made the suggestion in England, he made the suggestive point that it is the advancement in science itself in the realm of creating more extraordinary tools that paradoxically led to AIDS researchers violating accepted canons for identifying a new retrovirus. He began with some history. In 1976, when, quote, "the definition of isolation of a virus was established by the Pasteur Institute, It included all the steps we listed at the head of this program, simply formalizing the Koch postulates. As mentioned earlier, once the banding step was completed and one had a homogeneous set of particles at one gradient, one later step was to break the suspected retrovirus into its constituent proteins. Partly, though, this was a matter of the available technology. Even if one had wanted to, in 1976, it would have been impossible to go into a culture soup, one with varied types of particles, and fish out a likely-looking snippet of DNA or RNA so as to study whether it had the characteristics of a retrovirus. I may remind the listener here that a retrovirus is an extremely simple entity composed of an outer shell surrounding two strands of RNA. It also may not be out of place to remember some elementary biology. RNA contains a set of genes. A gene is one section of nucleotides that serves as a code for composing a protein. The whole operation of DNA and RNA is to activate specific genes in order to build proteins, which then are used in various ways to power the cells. As noted, circa 1976, to look at the genes in a suspected retrovirus entailed first isolating the virus in a gradient band. There was no way to do it. However, that necessity was swept aside with the advent of more high-powered laboratory instruments. Since the advent of very, very super technology which can actually detect one molecule of something in a billion cells, it is now considered sufficient to show a constellation of proteins without showing that it is that it aggregates into a complete viral particle. You can see this is just subjective or suggestive of a virus, not proof of it. In other words, in studying viruses with a new, more penetrating technology, bits and pieces of genes or the proteins made from those genes found in a culture can be investigated without having to take the trouble of deriving these materials from a pre-isolated virus. Lest you get the wrong idea, let me be clear that we are dealing with a major trend in HIV research, working with scraps, but they are nonetheless scientists who have been working with complete HIV chromosomes, that is, the virus's complete set of genes. These researchers I'll discuss a little later. The group who has worked with fragments have given birth to a rather dubious set of scientific practices, which involves engaging in full-scale research on viruses that have neither been isolated, which would be bad enough, nor even have been photographed as whole entities. And I might cite the massive research into the hepatitis B, for example, research that has been carried on full tilt in spite of the fact that, quote, we still can't culture hepatitis B in a petri dish, unquote. The point I'm trying to make is that technology has zoomed into space age wizardry, but the method of interpreting the data of that technology is still practically in the Stone Age. I've started to question whether HIV really exists or whether it's a laboratory artifact, unquote. I believe what they may have found is an odd protein here and there or the stretch of DNA or RNA, but do they all add up to a retrovirus or any other kind of virus? Unquote. This whole discussion may conjecture up for knowledgeable listeners one of the arguments made against nuclear weapons. So far, the validity of this argument has not been put to the test. If it had, we wouldn't be all sitting around in this discussion. But it went like this. The more atomic weapons we in the United States and our allies and enemies manufacture, the more we will be tempted to use them. Put crudely, there's an inherent tendency in mankind to play with toys. By analogy, once we had the ability to extract individual gene patches from a soup of cellular debris, there'll be a tendency to find a use for this ability. We can further redefine this insight by seeing it less as an overall human characteristic than as an aspect of the reign of experts. No one has brought this out with more devastating wit than Zygmunt Bauman in his Modernity and Ambivalence. There he writes that as a as a field, such as the creation of medical imaging devices, becomes more specialized and focused, quote, the chances grow that new skills, meaning new technical capabilities, will be invented, which will at first have no clear application, unquote. So, for instance, new techniques are developed that have the ability to view molecules and patches of RNA, but there is no particular need for them at the moment. The most likely result of this situation, he augments, would be their presence, meaning that in the new techniques, however, will bring into relief areas of the life world previously unnoticed, will redefine previously neutral or easy cope with elements of life routine, such as factors not adequately defined, opaque, ambiguous, insufficient controlled, as problems that need to be dealt with. In our example, this would mean that the ability to view bits of RNA from retroviruses was technically developed, and then it was fortuitously discovered that there was a great advantage to identifying viruses based upon a few strands of genetic material. The old way of first needing to isolate the virus in a banded gradient was now retroactively found to be time-consuming and inadequate. This is what Elliot Men means by unevolved Stone Age interpretations of data produced by super technology. The interpretations are naturally so, since they arose as justification of the use of highly expensive scientific techniques, not from a need for such techniques communicated by the scientists to developers of the technology. This is why Bauman characterizes such development in this way, quote, skill-seeking application masquerade as problems needing solution, unquote. Let me put it another way. When I was growing up as a baby boomer, we didn't have ADHD. We didn't have Ritalin. Then along came Ritalin, a drug, but there was no disease for Ritalin to treat. Well, it was easy enough to manufacture one. Now they have consensus. I ask any psychiatrist in this audience, you take a look at a child's brain, mapping of the brain, who has been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD. Then take a child not diagnosed and you show me the difference. You can't. There is no difference. You know it. I know it. I reviewed the scientific literature. I've just finished a major article on this, reviewing all the scientific literature. We cannot find a biological difference. We cannot find a chemical difference. We cannot find an organic difference. So maybe the difference is that we have a drug to fight it. So we merely created the disease. Think that's a wild and irresponsible statement? We'll see how the two major lawsuits against the makers of Ritalin play out. And watch in 2 or 3 years. We've been ahead of the curve on every one of these issues in my entire career. And I have a very strong feeling based upon reviewing the evidence clearly, and I will be one of the witnesses in that trial, that we will prevail. I believe the same thing has been done in AIDS, and now it's just the place to be. Call yourself an AIDS researcher, and irrespective of what AIDS is or is not, you've got a lifetime annuity. But let's ponder whether this newfound ability to study small portions of a retrovirus as RNA is as useful as it seems. We saw that Gallo and Montagnier and others had not gone the distance in isolating a virus, but worked with likely looking particles taken from a cell culture containing a heterogeneous mix of elements. But now, on closer examination, we'll see that they and those scientists who work with fragments had gone even further than established methodology, where, according to Koch's rules, at an advanced stage of trying to isolate a virus, the virologist should learn the chemical structure of the entity by breaking down the whole strands of DNA and RNA. This group of scientists begins with selected fragments. To put it more graphically, they did not pick out a retrovirus particle that, even if elbowing in among a crowd of other microscopic entities, was at least discrete. They were dealing with jagged, broken-off pieces of retrovirus. Quote, most analysis of so-called HIV genetic material, according to Neville Hodgkinson, in my opinion, many other people's opinion also, the leading science writer of the last quarter century, quote, are based on small segments of a purported virus genome, typically covering between 2 to 30% of it, since the longer sequences are rarely found, unquote. But it may be asked, if the scientist has only this small segment of the total chromosome to work with, then how can he or she get an idea of the larger structure? Dr. Stefan Lanka, probably the most outspoken virologist in the world today against the AIDS hypothesis, says the following. It may be hard to believe that all maps purporting to represent a whole retrovirus, including HIV, are always compilations, many bits and pieces cobbled together by their authors to be the best of their beliefs. They are collages, not complete retroviruses, nor its RNA in its entirety has ever been proven to exist. Unquote. Let me repeat that. And we're talking about a highly respected, published author, professor of virology from Germany. And he says, quote, it may be hard to believe that all maps purporting to represent a whole retrovirus, including HIV, are always compilations, many bits and pieces cobbled together by their authors to the best of their beliefs. They are collages. No complete retrovirus, nor its RNA in its entirety, has ever been proven to exist, unquote. Perhaps the danger of this approach is already evident. We have a soup of different entities in a patient's blood culture. In this soup, we are identified a number of pieces of supposed HIV RNA and DNA. And as you know, the original retrovirus would not have DNA, but would manufacture its own after it infected a cell, or the proteins they code for. Whatever of these pieces contain proteins or gene material, though typical of retroviruses, are then brought together in a thought experiment and said to be the components of one virus. What we have is a kind of paleontology of living entities that, like the dinosaur variety that tries to reconstruct, say, a 200-foot-long reptile from two of its buck teeth, here one is constructing the complex chromosome of an entity from a few genes or proteins. But the obvious difficulty, given such facts, as we have already noticed, such as that not only retroviruses are capable of budding or reverse transcriptase, is that pieces of the retrovirus, if it exists, may be mixed up in the imaginative creative creation of a whole virus with pieces of other non-retroviral material. Moreover, although the pieces being used are ones, as I noted, quote, thought typical of retroviruses, the idea that some gene sequences are found typically in viruses is more of a fond hope than a solidly proven fact. As Dr. Eliopoulos in her Perth group points out, it is not possible, quote, by sequencing a piece of DNA to say that it is truly a retrovirus unless prior proof exists that these sequences are present in a retroviral particle and nowhere else. There is nothing specific about the structure of retroviruses, unquote. Indeed, the most radical rethinkers of orthodoxy, such as Eliopoulos and Stephen Lanka, would say there is no retroviral material in the HIV construct at all. In Hodgkin's summary of her views, he holds, quote, the HIV found in the mitogenically stimulated laboratory cultures may be no more than a package synthesized as a result of activation and recombination of some of these many naturally present gene sequences, unquote. By the way, as an aside, when I was asked to interview, and I did, the leading proponent of the AIDS orthodoxy in Europe, and I was filming him, and then I asked them, could you show me in your laboratory where you're responsible for doing all the cultures of HIV in this country, an actual isolated, completely banded HIV virus? He said, of course. Well, later on, when we had finished our interview, I said, well, we're ready to go and look at your virus. Oh, he started tap dancing around that. And then I said, I'm going to ask you again. do you have a completely isolated, fully gradient, not a particle, not a piece, not a 2% of, a whole thing? And he just looked at me and he says, well, I'm not able to show it to you today. Nor has he shown me it at all or sent me any of his research on it. And this is the Gallo of Europe. So we lack what we ask for. It certainly is far from reassuring in light of the construction of retrovirus RNA and DNA from the paleontological point of view, that no two identical sequences for the HIV genome have been published. Eliopoulos states further, quote, one and the same patient may have different HIV DNA sequences. According to researchers from the Pasteur Institute, an asymptomatic patient can harbor at least 106 genetically distinct variants of HIV, unquote. This is not as disturbing as it may seem in that retroviruses are notorious mutators, and so it should not be taken as unusual that a patient has different strains of the virus. However, it would be beyond the realm of a normal mutation to change the number of genes on a chromosome. Nonetheless, quote, in 1990, the HIV genome was said to consist of 10 genes. In 1996, Montagnier reported that HIV possessed 8 genes, and according to Dr. Barry Sanosi, HIV has 9 genes. Well, can one be blamed, supposing the variations are due to the artifactual nature of the study rather than the actual traits of the HIV genomes? To put it in plainer lay language, you could ask whether the fluctuating number of genes attributed to the HIV virus in these types of experiments may not be due to the fact that the genome is being imaginatively cobbled together from analyzing segments rather than, as it would have been in the older way, when cruder tools were available, learned by starting with a whole genome for analysis. And the problems don't stop with genomes but extend to proteins that have been located with these attempts at piecemeal reconstruction. Three proteins have been associated with HIV are the P24 antigen, P41, and the 120. Remember, an antigen is a chemical marker and it's found on the surface of a cell or particle. P24 is noted as HIV antigen. P41 and GP120 are said to be components of the studs that protrude from the HIV shell and are used to fasten the virus to a likely looking host. However, taking the presence of these proteins in a culture as evidence in the presence of HIV is highly speculative. Dr. Eliopoulos states, quote, the P24 protein is not sufficient for diagnosing HIV infection because it's not specific. Indeed, no other HIV protein, not even P41, has been reported to react more often with sera from healthy at no risk AIDS individuals, unquote. Which is to say that in testing for the presence of these proteins, it is very common to find them in healthy, uninfected, no-risk individuals, which would indicate either that these proteins are not particularly distinctive of HIV or the tests used to identify them are unreliable, and so then would be the attempts to specify them as elements of HIV. It has been pointed out that the use of GP120 as an indicator of the presence of HIV is also problematic. Where P41 is said to reside in the base of the HIV studs, the protruding studs themselves are said to be composed of glycoprotein 120. It should be remembered that HIV has a life cycle, going from floating in the bloodstream to attaching to a cell, invading and replicating. If one had a specimen of HIV taken from its cruising stage, one might possibly find GP120 as part of the stud. If one were examining HIV inside infected cells, one would not find GP120 since the stud remains outside the cell. However, and this will lead us to the next section, all the intact HIV particles so far seen have been without knobs. Quote, given the fact that the P120 protein is said to be present only in knobs and that no cell-free HIV particles possessing knobs have been reported so far, it follows neither the particles in the culture supernatant or nor the pure virus will have G120. In other words, there's an anomaly in the evidence where GP120 is used as evidence for HIV in situations where that HIV does not have the knob structure that would include GP120. Now, I hope it is not misleading to focus on AIDS researchers who rely on fragments of HIV particle material for their imaginative constructions, since, as I've tried to keep clear, that this is not meant to imply that no specimens of intact HIV, at least intact except for their spikes, have ever been found or published in photographs. This is not true. All I've been getting at in the last two programs is that much research in the field has been carried out concentrating on segments rather than holes. Let's amplify the concluding point of that last section. Since it does not undercut the value of some of the specimens of HIV particles that have been found, after all, if one is using the blood of infected individuals, one would expect to find examples of both HIV in the first stage of its cycle, when it is studded with knobs, and in later stages. The fact that stage 1 examples are never found may be one reason, besides the impotence of the technological means being available, that led scientists to rely so exclusively on fragments of the retrovirus. To repeat the plain fact, quote, nobody has published EM of cell-free particles having the dimension of retroviral particles and also knobs, spikes, that is G120, unquote. But then, to take the implications as far as they will go, this also can be taken as proof of Eliopoulos' thesis that HIV does not really exist. Here's how she reasons. Quote, Gallo and all other retrovirologists agree that retrovirus particles are also spherical in shape, have a diameter of 100 to 100 nanometers, and are covered with knobs. The particles the two groups, Gallo and those at the Koch Institute, claim are HIV are not spherical, have diameters exceeding twice that permitted for a retrovirus, and none of them appear to have knobs. All AIDS experts agree that the knobs are absolutely essential for the HIV particle to lock onto a cell as the first step in infecting that cell. So, no locking knobs, no infection. If HIV particles do not have knobs, how is HIV able to replicate? And if it can't replicate, HIV is not an infectious particle. Unquote. Let's look at cloning. At this point, let's look at those scientists who have been able to extract complete specimens of what they believe is HIV DNA or RNA, which, to begin, we can correlate to what I've said previously about canonical isolation procedures. Now, and I'll keep making it into lay language, from one angle, it seems that while these positive thinking scientists have redefined the first step of what is it means to isolate a virus, casting aside the older requirements of obtaining a homogeneous band of particles before proceeding further, they have nonetheless complied to an extent with certain later steps of the procedure. We saw that part of the accepted particles for viral isolation was to take the retrovirus that had been banded out and put it back into a congenial culture of cells. Then, as a final step in proving one had a new retrovirus, it would be observed whether this added particle infected cells and replicated itself. These later steps are followed insofar as scientists such as Fisher, as reported by Duisberg, have taken full-length HIV DNA from infected cells and, quote, produced particles that contain reverse transcriptase, HIV-specific antigens, and produce infectious virus, unquote. The last point is the clincher insofar as it accommodates traditional procedures and finding that the virus reproduces and can infect other cells. There's another technique used in this work, which, with complete sets of DNA, one that has recently been greatly perfected, especially because it is one so centrally significant to bioengineering, which is one of the most profitable medical fields and ipso facto one in which research is most heavily funded. This is the cloning of genes and protein. Dr. Duisberg, who the listener may remember, believes that Koch postulates need to be set aside in favor of new principles, sees cloning as a central means toward establishing the reality of HIV. He explicitly wants to replace earlier methods of virus isolation with cloning, as the following quotation makes clear. He says, quote, Peter Duisberg, HIV has been isolated by the most rigorous methods science has to offer. An infectious DNA of 9.15 kilobases has been cloned from the cells of HIV antibody-positive persons. This DNA, quote, isolates HIV from all cellular molecules, even from viral proteins and RNA. Having cloned infectious DNA of HIV is as much isolation of HIV as one can possibly get, unquote. Now, here's where I have to draw a line, which is to say, as much as he holds this argument, what the AIDS dissidents have to say on isolation falls to the ground. It's not that in any sense he has won the argument, but that he has taken a stand that puts him outside the discussion, like a prize fighter who ends a bout by exiting the ring. For on this issue, the dissidents in this argument assume that opponents in the Orthodox Party hold, as most of them still do, to the old standards of viral isolation, and so these opponents are violating their own principles if they continue to consider HIV isolated before they have carried out the accepted method of establishing this. Duisberg has had the forthrightness to face the most fundamental questions involved, namely, what should be the standards of viral isolation? He answers by saying the older, widely agreed upon practices of this isolation need to be abandoned in favor of new ones that are more dependent upon new technology, since, quote, molecular cloning of infectious DNA of HIV exceeds in a positive way the criteria of the old Pasteur rules, unquote. I do not want to give the impression that this is the sole grounds on which Duisberg depends for his belief in the existence of HIV. He also bases his opinion on the presence of HIV antibodies in HIV-infected people and the usual absence of these antibodies in those without HIV, among other reasons. But among his reasons, it is only cloning which he brings up in wanting to replace conscious postulates. One may note how paradoxical a spectacle it is when a scientist, in a scrambling effort to defend a certain conservative position, drops some of the most hallowed standards of the profession, as if a military commander allowed the castle to be captured so that he could better guard the walls surrounding it. However, as I have striven to be open-minded about all scientific questions, so I will grant that the idea that the cherished, quote, Pasteur rules are no longer viable certainly is one way to combat the dissidents who claim AIDS scientists have failed to properly isolate HIV. Still, Duisberg's position would be more plausible if he made a systematic comparison of the older and newer methods of isolation rather than boldly asserting that the new methods is preferable. This said, let me add, a number of scientists have located weaknesses in Duisberg's opinions about cloning. The obvious point is that simply duplicating a particle proves nothing about what that particle is. Quote, since any piece of nucleic acid can be cloned in sequence, cloning and sequencing of a piece of nucleic acid cannot be used to prove the existence of retrovirus or its genome, unquote. That's according to Dr. Eliopoulos' Perth group. Instead, she argues, any value cloning may contribute to the study of retroviruses would lie further down the road, after the virus had been isolated by traditional procedures and its RNA shown to be, quote, a unique molecular entity belonging to particles with morphological, physical, and replicative characteristics of retroviral particles, unquote. Thus, she crosses swords with Duisberg by contending the cloning method is not sufficient to establish the existence of HIV. Now, since the propriety of naming an RNA HIV RNA is contingent upon prior isolation of a particle proven to be a retrovirus, on this basis alone, quote, the most rigorous method, i.e. molecular cloning of infectious HIV DNA, cannot prove HIV isolation. Quote, we agree that analysis of the proteins of a virus demands mass production and purification. It is necessary to do that. In this respect, they, meaning the Orthodox AIDS researchers, have not just partially failed, since they haven't purified, isolated the retrovirus, but totally failed, unquote. Thus, she argues against cloning a strand of DNA being an adequate replacement for older methods of viral isolation. This is not the place to engage in a full-scale tug-of-war over the validity of Koch's rules for isolation. That is why I purposely narrowed my discussion to Duisberg's ideas, although other scientists have advanced other thoughts on how to overhaul the accepted rules on isolation of a virus. An irony in my presentation is that until he decided to put forward his own substitute for Koch's rules, Duisberg himself was a key critic who challenged the establishment to live up to the Pasteur Institute's principles. Epstein lays out this chronology, quote, in the early 1980s, many researchers, including Gallo, seemed to have Koch's postulates at least generally in mind as they sought to isolate the virus. But when Duisberg needled them about not fulfilling these postulates, researchers argued that Koch's postulates were rarely satisfied in practice. Gallo himself said Koch, quote, had been taken too literally and too seriously for too long, unquote. Eventually, not only did Duisberg turn coat and come up with new rules for viral isolation, but others took this route. Notably, Dr. Warren Winkelstein from Berkeley School of Public Health proposed a five-part criteria for establishing the existence of a virus. What radically separates his postulates from the older version is that although this, his perhaps, could prove the existence of a virus, they did not do so by identifying or manipulating the particles. One of his suggested typical criterion, for example, is that the disease rate will be higher in those exposed to the virus than those not exposed. Another is that physical responses to exposure to the virus should follow a gradient, for example, as revealed in the slow decline of a patient's T cells. Thus, Winkelstein would change the rules more radically than Duisberg by moving outside the laboratory altogether and shifting the burden of proof to epidemiological evidence. If one accepted his principles, quote, isolation would no longer seem to be a very fit name for what he is doing to prove the existence of a new infectious disease. Looking in closer at the various attempts to find substitute for Koch's postulates would take us too far afield. However, at the conclusion of today's program, and we're coming up to that, let me simply say that I've given you this kind of detail simply because the mainstream media has led you to believe that there is absolutely no argument at all that HIV was isolated, it was purified, that there is no question that we had it. And then it was just a matter of who is most at risk and what treatment and what's a test to prove it. I had to take this time and effort today to, in effect, systematically show you that they have never come up with that complete and duplicatable element, and it's being challenged by all these other scientists. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346. I'm Gary Nall. Today's program is number 2666, and this is a continuation of our series on AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of HIV.